Okay, I want to start with one preface, and the preface is going to come from a non-humorous situation. Often as a Rebbe in Yeshiva, I would play basketball with my students, and I had the following advantage. The advantage is as follows. The students assume that the rabbi is not going to be particularly good. So if you're just pretty good, then they think that you're amazing. Right? Oh, the rabbi hit a jump shot. I heard Duke was interested in him when he was in high school. So I think there should be a similar phenomenon regarding humor, that you don't really expect the Gemara to tell a joke. So if the Gemara does so, right, you have to decide that it's hilarious instantly, right? Because it's just, that's part of humor, right? The shock, right? What's the joke doing there? So hopefully we're going to be able to work off that. And the shiur today was going to have two parts. In one part, I'll try to show you that the Gemara does tell jokes. I think we'll see some concrete examples where the Gemara clearly knows that it's being funny. The second part, and perhaps the more important part, will be discussing perhaps a religious theory of humor, a philosophy of humor. What role does humor have in religious life? Because in theory, if you think about it, one might have argued that humor doesn't really belong. You could have said, you know, religious life is a serious business. We're trying to be devout. We're trying to be responsible. But maybe that and levity doesn't go together. And we'll see that humor does have a place. We'll try to figure out exactly what place it has. So let's start with the first part, trying to argue that the Gemara does have a sense of humor. Okay, now I'm not an expert on humor, but I'd like to divide jokes into three types, and we'll see if we can find all three in the Gemara. Okay, one kind of joke, of course, is a pun or a play on words. This is something that there are radically different opinions about. Some people love it, some people hate it. I find myself, I don't know why, I often do them subconsciously while teaching. I can't really figure out why. I guess I have to ask my therapist. I'll give you an example. I was just met two students recently, and they both are into the interface between Judaism and ecology, right, and the environment. So I thought for a second, Judaism and ecology, that's a real growing field. So I just did it by accident. I wasn't trying to say it, it just came out. But that is one kind of joke, right? A play on words, a pun of some kind or another. Another kind of joke is what we usually call slapstick, right? I was never a fan, but for those who like the Three Stooges, right, a pie in the face or that kind of thing. That, we'd imagine, we're probably going to be less likely to find in the Gemara. Although, believe it or not, I did find one example, I think. Okay, so that would be slapstick. A third kind of humor would be like a clever one-liner. Maybe it's the most common kind of humor in professional comedians. Right, a sharp line, a witty insight. That would be the third kind of humor. We'll now see, I think, that all three of those types do belong in the Gemara. So let's start with the page 2 here, the first source. This is the most famous joke in Gemara. So of all the jokes we'll see, this is the one probably most of you are familiar with. The Gemara in Pesachim wants to know, let's say somebody cleans the house for Chametz a little bit early in the game. They clean the house and there's still a day or two before Pesach. So you have the Chametz all in one area. It sounds like you're good to go. But maybe you're afraid that a rodent or a weasel of some kind has moved the Chametz to another area. If you are indeed afraid of such a thing, so then you might have to do another bedikah. Right, this is a pretty important question, like what's the status of the bedikah you did a bit earlier? So the Gemara raises a contradiction. Let's look at the first source. Umi amrinan ein choshishin shema garachuda. Do we say we're not afraid that the weasel moved it? Right, there's one source that says, you don't have to worry about weasels. Search for your chametz and you're good. Wait, v'haktani seifa, but we learned in the latter source, the latter part, ma shemeshaya, whatever you have left over of chametz, yanichenu betzina, make sure it's under lock and key, it's hidden away. Shelo yehet zerech bedikah acharav. So that you not need another bedikah. So this latter source indicates that you would in fact be nervous about the weasel moving it around. If you didn't put it bitzinah, you weren't careful about it, you'd have to do another search. Okay, so Abaye has a very interesting answer. Amar Abaye, lo kash, there's no contradiction. Ha ba'arba'asar, ha ba'shloshasar. Depends what day of Nisan it is. Are you doing this on the 14th or on the 13th? Now this seems a little bit odd. Why should it matter whether it's the 14th or 13th of Nisan? So the Gemara continues. B'shloshasar d'shchiach rifta b'kulu bati. On the 13th, there's a lot of bread in every house. Lo mitzana. The weasel will not store it away. Namely, we're attributing a great degree of intelligence to this rodent. We say, the weasel knows. The weasel looks at his calendar, says it's the 13th of Nisan. The Jews still have all their chametz there. Nothing to worry about. I don't need to store away for tomorrow. I'm good. Right? He just has his lunch and he goes back to his weasel hole. But Barbasar, if it's the 14th of Nisan, the weasel looks around and says, I'm in trouble. Right? The weasel is no fan of matzah. So he looks around and says, I'm not going to have chametz. Mitzana. Then the weasel will store it away. Now, this is a pretty remarkable answer, that the weasel is aware of the surroundings, 13th verse 14th of Nisan, and will function accordingly. And as you'd imagine, the Amora, who always argues with Abaya, Rava, is going to protest. But here's the interesting thing. If you had to phrase the protest, what should the Gemara say? One should say, V'chi chulda chachamahi. Is the weasel intelligent? Is the weasel so smart to make these kind of calculations? But the Gemara does not say that. Amar Rava, V'chi chulda nevi'ahi. Is this weasel a prophet or prophetess? D'yada d'ha'idna arbesar, that knows that it's 14th, etc. Now, here I think it's clear the Gemara is trying to make a pun or a play on words. Okay, as many of you may know, there is actually a prophetess named Chulda. Right, in fact, if you're curious, very interesting Gemara, the one Megillah Daf Yadalid, that says that there's seven female prophetesses in our tradition. It's a fascinating list. Just, this is not really top of my topic, but I can't resist a good tangent. Because on the list, you have one of the most, but not the others. It's a very interesting Gemara. Sarah is considered a Nevi'ah there, but Rachel, Rivka, and Leah are not. So if anyone's curious about who are the female prophetesses in our tradition, so Megillah Daf Yadalid and Aleph list the seven of them, but one does not need, I guess because I'm a Rebbe Yeshiva, I prove Chulda's status from a Gemara Megillah, but one does not have to go to Gemara Megillah. It's a pasuk in Sefer Malachim and Devar Yamim, that there is a female prophetess named Chulda, and she's consulted in one very specific occasion. I'm not going to do the story inside, but it's right there in source 2 for someone who would like to look up the original. I think it's absolutely clear the Gemara is trying to make a pun here. Right, again, it's why use the word Nevi'ah? It's not about the prophetic powers of the weasel. It's about the wisdom or understanding of the weasel. So if it didn't want to make this pun, it could have just said, V'chi chulda chachamai, is the chulda wise. So this is clear. So we at least have one pun in the Gemara. Okay, let's go to category 2. As I mentioned, we thought that slapstick might be a little bit more difficult to find. But I came up with one. Let us look at source 3. Excuse me, source 3. Gemara and Baba Kama. Chanan Bisha takale lehu gavra. A fellow named Chanan Bisha hit somebody. Okay, taka hit. Now, there's various fines for assault. Atala kameda Rav Huna, they came before Rav Huna, who was going to be the judge in Bavel. Amalei zil havle palga dezuza. Pay up half a zuz. That's the fine for you hitting this fellow. A half a zuz. Okay, great. Havle zuza maka. Now, Rav Huna had an old zuz. Now, many of you may relate to this, right? Let's say you get an old dollar bill that's a little ripped or there's a piece of tape in the middle. You're always nervous that no store owner is going to take it, right? You go from store to store trying to find some place to pass that dollar bill on to somebody else. So Rav Huna had a zuz like that. The same thing could happen with coins. Like, we're not used to it with our coins. Like, we don't imagine our quarters getting ruined. But various parts of human history, right? Your coin could also start to go. So you have an old zuz. Rav Huna owns, Chanan Bisha owes half a zuz for hitting the guy. And he's got this old zuz. Okay. Boy lemitvile mine palga de zuza. So he wants to use it to pay it up. He'll get some change. Maybe he'll give it to the victim and get half a zuz back. Loive mishtakale. But as often happens, nobody wants to take it. I don't want that. Then I'll have trouble passing on that zuz. So Chanan Bisha thinks for a second. Takale achrina v'yavanile. So you hit him again. Right. There you go. Once you hit him again, a very clever solution. Right. He owes him a zuz. There's no issue of getting change. And he gives him the bad zuz. Now, again, I cannot imagine that the Gemara did not know that this was funny. Right? The Gemara did not just say, okay, this happened. Right? This is funny. Arguably, there's something funny of almost a slapstick quality to it. Right? He can't get change for his zuz. So he hits him again to obviate the problem of change. So again, that was tough to find an example of slapstick in the Gemara, but I believe we have done so. Okay. Let us go to the easiest category. The easiest category is to find clever lines. Like, if you think of rabbinic humor or Jewish humor in general, that's probably going to be the largest category, right? More than puns and plays on word, and certainly more than slapstick. So let's go to source 4. There's a Mishnah at the end of Sota, which lists various traits that have gone out of the world when a different Tana passed away, right? We want to associate a Tana with this trait. Like, let's say, I don't know, you have a big Baal Ches in your community who Chas V'Shalom passes away. You might say, when X dies, that's the end of Baal Chesed. So the Mishnah says this about various traits. When this one died, this trait left the world. When the other one passed away, a different trait left the world. On that list is the death of Rebbe Yehuda Nasi. And it says that when Rebbe Yehuda Nasi passed away, there's no more anava, no more humility, and yirat chet, no more fear of sin. So let's look at this Gemara. By the way, these are the last two lines of Masechet Sotah. I've often wondered if Chazal purposely put a joke at the end. It's like the reward. If you made it through all 48 pages of Masechet Sotah, then you get a joke in the last 2 lines. So let's see what we have here. But it's a little bit unfair because we're just skipping to it. Mishamate Rebbe, when Rebbe passed away, but la anava v'yirat chet. Now there's no more humility, and there's also no more fear of sin. Amar le Rav Yosef Latana. Now just to clarify, Rav Yosef is not talking to a Tana. Latana means to the person who recites Tanitic sources. So Rav Yosef says to the person reciting these sources, lo titni anava. Don't say there's no more humble people in the world. Dikana, because there's me. Then what do you mean? What about yours truly? How could you say that humility has left the world? Now, I think also the Gemara knew that this could be funny, although there is an interesting pshat of the Gra, which I don't think is the pshat. Some of you may know, the Gra says, maybe there was a fellow named Anna. So Rav Yosef's not talking about himself, right? Lo titni anava. What do you mean there's no more humble people? What about that guy in the fourth row of shul named Anna? He is still humble. But I don't think, as far as I know, we don't have any other evidence in the Gemara for a fellow named Anna, and the simplest reading here would be Anna me. And indeed, this is the way the overwhelming majority of Mefarshim take this line. So again, if someone, there's a clever line, right? What do you mean there's no more humble people? There's me. Alright, let us see one more clever line, and we'll get to what I think is the more significant part of Shir, the religious philosophy of humor. Let us go to source 5. This is a tremendous story. Okay. Kiyim b'torat Hashem chefzo. The Torah of Hashem is your desire. One piece of information that's helpful in this Gemara is to realize this is the second pasuk in all of Sefer Tehillim. So if someone is going to start to learn through Sefer Tehillim, they will get to this pasuk very quickly. Now, what does this pasuk mean that the Torah of Hashem is your desire? What's that emphasis on Chefzo? So the Gemara says as follows. I lost the line of the story here. Okay, the line I lost is as follows. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi has pshat in that pasuk. His pshat is, Ein Adam Lomei Torah, learning Torah really works best when it's where you want to be, or it's the subject or work that you want to be learning. Those of us who are in education, actually all of us at least went through education, right? You know, in many educational circumstances, elective courses work much better than required courses. I think this is true perhaps on every level of education. Because the idea is, in an elective course, like people chose to be there. They're excited about the topic, they're interested. That's usually something that works more effectively. Interestingly, that the Gemara is basically saying that right here. Right, Ein Adam Lomei Torah Mimakom Shel Libo Chafetz. Right, if you really want to be there, you want to be learning this. Usually, the Limud Torah will be on a stronger level. So that's Rebbe's pshat in that pasuk. Okay, now let's do the story. Levi Rabbi Shimon BeRebbe Yatvi Kamei DeRebbe. So there's a shir of two people here, Levi and Rabbi Shimon, the son of Rebbe, and Rebbe's giving shir. A very nice little scene here. VeKapaski Sidra. They're learning Salik Sifra. They finished the work. So now here's a good educational rule. If you have a class with two students, do not take a class vote about what to do. Because it's obvious what will happen, and indeed, that's what occurs. So they take a class. Rebbe's very democratic. He turns to the yeshiva guys and says, what would you like to learn next? So let's see what happens. Levi Amar, Laitu Lan Mishle. Right, bring us Mishle. I've been curious about Mishle for years, not learned very much in the world of yeshivot. Let's learn Mishle. That's what Levi would like to do. Reb Shimon, Rebbe Amar, Laitu Lan Tilim. Rabbi Shimon says, no, Tehillim is the way to go. Like we say it in davening a lot, it's an important thing to know. So there's a standoff, right? A one-to-one vote. Should they learn Mishle or should they learn Tehillim? Now, obviously someone has to lose. Kaf Yila Levi. So they force Levi, Vaitu Tehillim. So I guess Rebbe voted with Tehillim. That's what he wanted to teach, not Mishle. By the way, I guess there should be a corresponding rule that Ein Adam Melamei Torah Makom Shalibo Chafetz, right? It also works better if the teacher is excited about what he's teaching. Okay, so Kimatu Hacha. Now don't forget, this is the second pasuk in all of Sefer Tehillim. So after they made this move, it did not take long to get there. Right? Let's say it's 12 minutes. I don't know how long he said shot in the first pasuk, but it's 12 minutes into the new area of learning. Kimatu Hacha, they arrive here. Kim Betarat Hashem Chefzo. Pirish Rebbe, Rebbe said Pshat Vamar. Ein Adam Lomei Torah Mimakom Shel Libo Chafetz. Well, learning only really works if it's what you want to be learning. Amar Levi, Rebbe, Natata Lana Rishit Lamod. So Levi said, okay, I guess I can go now. Right, goodbye. Right, after all, I voted for Mishle. Here we are in Sefer Tehillim. So what am I doing here? Now, again, I think this is a clever law, and I think the Gemara knew this was clever and perhaps a bit funny. I don't imagine that Levi necessarily stormed out of the room and like went to find a Mishle class in some other part of town. They probably all chuckled and went on to the third pasuk of Sefer Tehillim. But again, I think you do have a clever, funny line in the Gemara. So I think at the very least we've established that the Gemara is not averse to telling jokes, be it a pun as in the Chulda example, or perhaps even a little bit slapstick in the Chanan Bisha example, or these kind of clever, witty lines where like, there's no, what do you mean there's no more humble people, there's me, or what Levi has just said. But let's now try to figure out where humor fits in, though. Where does humor play a role in religious life? I should just say one other thing. I always feel bad when I give this year, I'm going to mislead people. Right, those who are now going to plow through Shas in Daf Yomi or some other venue, you should not expect a joke every five lines, right? It does tell jokes, but it's not its main occupation, right? You might have to wait a while before you get to the next joke. All right, let's start with where humor fits in. So we're going to go to source 6. This is a tremendous, tremendous insight of the Tiferet Yisrael. And here I can't resist a little bit of historical background in the Tiferet Yisrael. He's a figure that's a little bit forgotten now, which I think is a mistake. And I'll tell you why he's forgotten. He's forgotten because a good thing happened. The good thing that happened is Pinchas Kahati did a remarkable life work, and he made Mishnayot very accessible. Right? He wrote an explanation, such a clear and lucid Hebrew, really a remarkable achievement. By the way, you should know, Kahati wasn't even a Rav. He worked in a bank. It's really a fascinating thing. He was a bank teller, a banker on the side, wrote the clearest parish on the Mishnah in the last who knows how many years of Jewish history. So that's a great thing he did. There's no denying it. I only have one complaint. Before Kahati came out, people used to use the older version of Mishnah was one that had the Tosfos Yom Tov and the Bar Tanura and the Tiferes Yisrael, the Yachanu Boaz on bottom. Which those of you who would like to learn Mishnayot in depth, it's really wonderful. I highly recommend it. I admit if one's trying to just plow through Mishnayot, then probably Kahati is the way to go. But if one would like to analyze it a bit more and learn Mishnayot that way, so really you should get the old edition and use that, the tremendous commentaries. In particular, I'm very enamored of the commentary of the Tiferet Yisrael. Also, it's called Yachanu Boaz. Right? Yachan is like his running commentary. He's like Rashi and Tosfot. Yachan is his Rashi and Boaz is his Tosfot. He was a Rav in Germany in the 1800s named Rav Yisrael Lifshitz. He was a very fascinating fellow. Just give you one example, and if I go on a Tiferet Yisrael tangent, we'll never get back to humor, but I'll give you one example. One of the things that appeals to me, everything interested him. Right? There was no aspect of Torah, perhaps even no aspect of life that did not interest him. I'll give you a great example. If you look in the 8th parak of Yoma, the 8th parak of Yoma discusses certain diseases. Right? It discusses what if you have this disease and it's Yom Kippur or it's Shabbos, what could you do? So I think it's a bit rare in a rabbinic commentary that Tiferet Yisrael says, once we're discussing diseases, I'll tell you the cure for some of them. In fact, if you have scurvy, you should eat citrus fruits. Right? It's right there. Look it up. In the Tiferet Yisrael in Yoma, he also says what you should do if you're bitten by a rabid dog. Though I believe the cure for that he suggests is less successful than the cure for scurvy. But I'm just using this to show the wide range of the Tiferet Yisrael's commentary. You normally do not expect to find the cure for scurvy in parish on the Mishnah in Maseches Yom. So let us see this, with that introduction, let us see what we have here in Source 6. Rabbi Dosa ben Hurkanus Omer. So here's the Mishnah about what does Rabbi Dosa teach? There are four problematic things. Shena shel shachrit, the morning sleep. Yayin shel tzarayim, the afternoon wine. Vesichat yeladim, childish chatter. The yeshiva batek nisio cha ameharetz, and the gatherings of the ignorant. Here, presumably, batek nisio does not mean shoals, but rather gatherings. Motzin et adam min holam. They take a person out of this world. These are four negative things. Now, what exactly are these? Do they represent categories? Is there some kind of special list here? What's the problem with these things? Let us now go to Rav Lifshitz's commentary. I think he does something absolutely fascinating, and we'll get to humor in 1 second. Let's go to Samach Zayin. Samach Dalet. Zachar Daladvar is mentioning four things. Shetzrichim ma'od labriya taguf ulashlamat adam. Something fascinating is going on here. It says we actually need these four things. These four things, which the Mishnah is pretty negative about, they all represent categories that are necessary. Va'afilu hachi, but even so, kishelo yizaher behen, but if you're not cautious with them, yovad al yadan olomo. Again, like the Mishnah said, right? Motzina tadam. You could lose your world. So Rav Lifshitz has already made an interesting move, because the Mishnah seemed to be fairly negative about these four things, and Rav Lifshitz tells me, no, they all have their place, but done the right way. Now let's see what all four of them represent. It's very interesting. He takes them all kind of symbolically. Samachay, what was the first thing? The morning sleep. Mashel akol kovid va'atzlut. That's about a heaviness, a lethargy, or perhaps we should call it rest and relaxation. Vahar miyuto yafeh. Certainly a little bit of that. A little lethargy is okay. It's good. A little rest. Vitzarech ma'od labriya tagof. You need it for health. Shiyanuach achar yigiyato. Okay, there might be some typos here because I don't have this on a computer program. I typed it in. It should be shiyanuach. Sorry about that. Shiyanuach achar yigiyato. You should rest after your effort. Ah, so now what does the Tiferet Yisrael say? Sheina Shel Shacharis stands for rest. But if you sleep through the morning, what does that mean? Rest is not just something that gets you back to being productive. Rest has started to become a little bit too dominant a feature in your life. Like, life is about getting a lot of sleep. So the first category is rest and relaxation. Judaism is not against rest and relaxation. It has its place. Miutoya fet. Sheina Shel Shacharis stands for the person who has taken it too far, right? If you're still asleep at 10:30 in the morning, we have a problem. That is Sheina Shel Shacharis. Okay, let's do the other three categories. What is wine in the afternoon going to represent? So if you skip down to the third line, Samach Vav, he says, Mashal l'redifat hatanugim. This is a parable for chasing after physical pleasures. Now again, wine could be part of, symbolize a life of celebration. Rav Lifshitz is going to make the same point, right? Torah is not against physical pleasure, right? You have a good cholent on Shabbos afternoon. This is not not religiously problematic, quite the contrary. But that can't be the meaning of life, right? The meaning of life is not a big party or some kind of hedonistic celebration. So Yayin Shel Tzaraim, again, stands for physical pleasure has its place in Yutoya Feh, but don't overdo it. Okay, now things get very interesting. Let us go to the second two categories. Let us skip to Samach Zayin. Okay, what about childish chatter? What does that represent? I'm now in the fifth line of the Tiferet Yisrael in Source 7. Hu mashal l'schok v'hitalut. This is a parable for joking around. You know, kind of a little bit of a youthful joking. Shigam ken miuto yafeh. That also has its place. A little bit of that is good. But now I want to set the stage here, because he does something very interesting. If he follows the model that he had before, what did he do till now? He kept making quantitative splits, right? Rest is good. Don't overdo it. Physical pleasure is good. Don't overdo it. Let's say you try to plug in a quantitative split here. It'd be a little odd, right? The religious Jew should tell three jokes a day, right? Seven is excessive levity. One is excessive seriousness. We'll tell exactly how many jokes you should tell every day. Right? That would seem a little bit odd. Right? So says the Tiferet Yisrael, no. Here it's not about quantity. It's not about the number of jokes you tell every day. Let's keep going. I think a very, very important point coming up. Lahavlig ulisameach hanefesh. Jokes are great. They gladden the heart. We're certainly encouraging them, making people feel good. People should be happy. They're more productive that way. Of course, tell a joke. But avorak imanashim gdolim. But only with people of stature. Now, this is fascinating. You might think you joke around with the people who are not of stature. Says the professor, no, you joke around with the people of stature. Why is that? Sheyesh b'mili debdichuta imahem divrei haskel. Because their jokes have something of wisdom to it. Now, the Tiferet Yisrael is making a very, very sharp point. And if you think about it, think about all the funny people you know in life. I think you'll see that there's different kinds of categories. There's some people, there's a tremendous wisdom that is always integrated with their humor. You might think of a Rav who once taught you, or a professor who once taught you. Some of the jokes are somehow well integrated into things they know. In fact, often because of that, you don't get the jokes, right? Because you have to know the Gemara and Erechin they're talking about when they made the joke. But this is one kind of humor. And I would say it's not just about knowledge. I'll make another distinction, which I think fits as well. There's a humor of refinement and humor of coarseness. If you think about professional comics, very often there's a coarse quality to it. Either the coarseness is manifest in profanity, it might be manifest in aggressiveness. Like only once in my life was I in a comedy club. There used to be a place on the west side that used to have the funniest rabbi competition. So since my brothers and I knew every rabbi who was entered, we went. But I remember afterwards they had a professional comic guy. I was like a little bit taken aback how aggressive he was to the crowd. You're almost like you're looking for somebody in the audience to pick on. So there's, and again, I think we think back about humor of our youth. There's a sophomoric humor, right? There's leaving the water on the door so that when the counselor comes into the bunk, right, it falls on his head. Or in fourth grade when you put I am stupid on the back of your friend with a piece of tape, right? These are things, this is not the kind of humor a religious person should be involved in. So notice what Rav Lifshitz has done. When it came to rest, or to physical enjoyment, he made a quantitative distinction. Do that, but don't overdo it. When it comes to humor, he makes a qualitative distinction. There is a humor that is appropriate for a religious person, and there's a humor that's inappropriate. There's a humor of wisdom and a humor of frivolity. There is a humor of refinement and a humor of coarseness. I'll give you a good example of this. When I went to Australia once with Counterpoint, I was with my friend named Moshe Rothschild, who's now a rabbi in Florida, and he had an idea for a tremendous program, really tremendous. So Moshe said, you know, we'll show the high school kids? We'll show them a brief clip of Bill Cosby, and we'll show them a brief clip of Eddie Murphy. And the point of the program was, you can be funny without being coarse, and you can be funny with a lot of cursing and a lot of rude comments. So I, at the time, thought this was the greatest program ever. The one difficulty was all the kids agreed that Eddie Murphy was funnier. But with that exception, I actually thought it was a tremendous point. And I actually do not agree that Eddie Murphy's funnier, by the way. But I thought it was a very, very sharp point. And that is what Rav Lifshitz is saying. So we have, at this point, perhaps our first principle in the Jewish conception of humor. Humor is a good thing to cheer people up, make people happy. Humor could be a wonderful tool. But again, humor shouldn't be at somebody's expense. It shouldn't be coarse. There should be an intelligence and almost a morality to humor. Okay, terrific. Now, I want to get back to humor, but since we're ready here, I want to point out what the Tiferes Yisrael does in the last category, because it's really interesting. What was the last category? The gatherings of the ignorant. So let's see what he does. Look at Samachet. Mashal l'sicha b'tela. What does the gatherings of the ignorant count for, symbolize? It symbolizes idle chatter. Hugamkin miutoyefe. Here it is. This is the only rabbinic endorsement of idle chatter in all of rabbinic literature. Here it is. A little bit of sicha b'tela is good. Why is it good? Acher shita mel adam b'chachma. You worked hard. You were really thinking all day. You were learning a sugya. You were at work. It was tough. Ra'ui lo lishtasheya k'tzad ben re'av. It's okay. It's appropriate to be a little playful among your colleagues. B'dvar m'shem abakach. Right? You don't have to discuss, not every conversation has to be about a ktsos or about, I don't know, a difficult passage in Kierkegaard. Okay, you could have just a regular conversation. You don't need to concentrate so much. You'll get to rest a little bit. Notice what he does once again. Only among people who are honorable. Why? So if you think about it, this is very fascinating, and it's something for all of us to think about. Even in Sicha Batela, there is a qualitative distinction to be made. So to speak, according to Tiferes Yisrael, if you think about it, it's correct. There is a quality idle chatter, and there is a lesser quality idle chatter. Right? And again, you could think about things where there's still a certain wisdom and a certain refinement, even though you're not discussing the most deep topics. And there is something else, like you're bored at the Shabbos table, you start discussing every scandal you could think of in the community, right? There is a sicha b'tela that is far less qualitative. So I just, in general, before we get back to humor, I just think this is a powerful Tiferet Yisrael educationally. The idea that even when we're doing other things, whether we're learning, engaged in idle chatter, they certainly have their place according to Rav Lifshitz, but that we should be making qualitative distinctions in that regard, I think is a very, very significant point. Okay, let us now go back to our examples before. What do we have Rav Lifshitz arguing? That we should have a humor of quality, a humor of intelligence, a humor of refinement. Okay. What about the examples we saw before? So I think it's interesting, if you look at those examples carefully, and maybe that there's an educational point to be made about all of the above. The last two examples, I think, will be the most powerful, but I think we're going to look at all four. Adam, can I trouble you to get me just a cup of water? Sorry to bother you. Thanks. Okay. So now, let us take a look at Source 8. Now, just to give you a little bit of background here, there is a question what Dayanim are allowed to do outside of the land of Israel. Some of you may know that what we have today is not real smicha. We have today is just a piece of paper that says you finished some institution's course. It has no halachic impact. Right? Those who are in smicha, that you cannot do anything halachically after receiving smicha you couldn't do before. But once there was real smicha, and real smicha gives the court ability to do certain things, certain fines, perhaps, capital punishment, perhaps. So there's a question, well, real smicha is only in Eretz Yisrael proper. So what about courts in the land of Bavel? What were courts in Bavel allowed to do? And there's a suggestion at one point that maybe they can only do things that involve restitution, right? Maybe only paying back what you took. But fines, right, obviously society depends on restitution much more than it depends on levying fines. Thank you very much. So there's a whole question whether the courts in Bavel could levy fines. So let's take a look here at Source 8. So Rabbeinu Tam is discussing this point. Ain done in dine gzeilot b'Bavel. Well, what kind of theft cases are we allowed to judge in Bavel? He says, wait, let's look through the Gemara. Tuva ashkachan d'dano to b'Bavel. We actually find a lot of examples where they judge these cases in Bavel. Now I'm going to skip to the second line in the middle of the line. D'bishlama achavalot lo kashalan. There's no difficulty regarding chavalot, right? What's chavala? Assault. Avgaf damin and chanan bisha takale lachave v'danei rapapa. There it is. What just happened? In the halakhic analysis, he uses our case. Wait, apparently whoever the judge was there, I mean, his gerusa seems to be rapapa, not ravuna, they were willing to fine chanan bisha for assaulting somebody. What emerges? That was a funny story, right? He couldn't get changed for his oz, so he hit the fellow again. But maybe lurking in that story was a halachic principle, right? Is this something that is actionable in Bavel? So again, it's a clever line, but maybe the Gemara was simultaneously making a clever line and making a halachic point. Okay, the last two examples I think are even more powerful. Let us go back to Rav Yosef. What did Rav Yosef say? What do you mean there's no more humble people in the world? You forgot about me? Now, I would argue Rav Yosef for sure is trying to make a deeper point. It's funny, and he knows it's funny, but he's trying to say something else as well. And here there's a crucial religious question, which is, what is the religious ideal of humility? And you could have a whole range of opinions. It's very interesting, you know, the Mesilas Yesharim is perhaps the canonical muster work. You don't often find people arguing with Mesilas Yesharim. In fact, I'm aware of one example, which we'll discuss right now. But the Netziv in Bamidbar takes on the Mesilas Yesharim. He says the Mesilas Yesharim identifies Anav with Shval Berech. So they're the same thing. Anav, humility, Shval Berech, lowliness of spirit. And the Netziv says that's not true. The Netziv seems to be nervous that you'll have a religious conception of humility where you basically think pretty poorly of yourself. Like, I don't really have good qualities, and I've really never really accomplished anything in life. The Netziv seems to think that that's not a healthy way to go. That's not the religious ideal of humility. Let's look at Source 9. Wonderful passage in the Netziv. The reason why this is in Bamidbar Yudbet, of course, is because there Moshe is described as Anav Mod Mikal Adam. So he wants to figure out, well, Moshe is humble. What does it mean to be humble? That's what we got here. Umashmut Anav, what does it mean to be humble? She'enu choshesh lechvodo v'tzaro. You're not so concerned about your honor. V'lo mishum shu shafel ba'atzmo. But not because you have low self-esteem. Says the Netziv, humble, humility, does not mean that you think poorly of yourself. It means you're not demanding social recognition all the time. It means if somebody else gets chosen to be honored at the shul dinner, you don't have a conniption. You could deal with it. It means if somebody else gets shlishi and you got something else, you didn't get an aliyah, you could deal with that too. Which again, this is something that I've been mystified by for years. I have to admit, I cannot say I'm above ego things, certainly have an ego, but like getting riled up over which aliyah you got, that one always passed me by. Never fully understood that, but I've been in shuls where this has happened, where you are yelling at each other about this, so apparently it is an issue. Says the Netziv, to be humble means, I mean, you can deal with it. Right? You don't need to get recognition, you don't need to be mentioned all the time. That is the authentic humility. But not that you then, I say, I'm really a lousy person. You can actually be aware of your qualities. And Netziv says, this is not a problem. Now he's going to try to prove that this is true. So his proof is very interesting. Let's look now at the end of the second line. V'hainu d'amar Rav Yosef shilhei mesechet sota. This is what Yosef says at the very end of Masechet Sota. Lo titni anav v'tikana. Don't teach humility that that's gone, there's still me. Now here we have to do something very interesting. See why the Netziv thinks this proves his theory. So let's do one part, but I think you'll all understand there's a difficulty, and we'll try to resolve that difficulty. The Netziv's first argument is as follows. If anava, if humility means you think you're terrible, so then how could Rav Yosef say, what do you mean there's no more humble people? There's me. How could you say that if anav means you think you're not very good? Now, I think there is an obvious question to ask the Netziv here, which is, but even according to his pshat, isn't that demanding social recognition? If you say, what do you mean there's no humble people, there's me. So I think there's a reason why it works better for the Netziv. And for this, you need to know another Gemara. There's a Gemara in there's a Gemara in Hariot and Brachot, where they're trying to figure out who should be the Rosh Hashiva in Pumbedita. And there's two candidates. One is Rabbah, and one is Rav Yosef. It says Rav Yosef is a Sinai. He knows everything. He's like at Sinai, getting all the information. And Rabbah is an Oker Harim. He doesn't know as much as Rav Yosef, but he's good at reasoning. He's good at Talmudic analysis. Right? There's a famous thing, right? There are different kinds of scholars in this world. Those that are erudite and know it all, and those that don't know as much, but you're amazed by their powers of reasoning. So it's a very interesting pedagogic question. Who should be Rosh Yeshiva? Sinai or Oker Harim? Now, since this is a shir about humor, I feel like I should tell a yeshiva's joke. So I'm going to tell a yeshiva's joke. Here it goes. Someone once asked as follows. How could the Gemara have a question, who wins, Sinai or Oker Harim? Think about it. It's obvious. You have the mountain Sinai, and you have the uprooter of mountains. So, of course, the Oker Harim beats Sinai. So you have to remember what each one stands for to get the joke, right? Oker Harim is the guy who's good at reasoning. Sinai is the one who knows everything. So, again, the question is, how could the Sinai stand the chance? Oker Harim uproots mountains. Ah, the Oker Harim doesn't know where to find the Sinai. That's the problem. Okay, so in any case, the Gemara wants to know which one wins. So the Gemara actually says they chose the Sinai. They said the Sinai should win. Let Rav Yosef be the Rosh Yeshiva. But Rav Yosef turned it down. Very, very interesting Gemara. Yes, no, let it go to Rabbah. Why Rabbi Yosef turned it down is a topic of fascinating discussion, but it's not for us right now. Now, this was a decision with tremendous implications, because Rabbi Yosef did not have this for 22 years. Right? He turned it down, and then you turn it down, no, you don't know how long it's going to take. Rabbah was a Rashiva for the next 22 years. Not only that, says the Gemara, but during that entire time period, Rav Yosef afilu umna lebeite lo chalaf. Now, Rashi there says that the uman is the bloodletter. And for our purposes, the bloodletter is basically the doctor. Now, it's very interesting. Gemara will talk about a bloodletter as being the medical professional. Sometimes when we're learning that, we think that that's, okay, that's what they did 1,600 years ago. That's what they did 300 years ago, right? Bloodletting only stopped pretty recently, I believe in the 1700s, if I remember correctly. So the bloodletter is your doctor. So now, what happens there? So the Gemara says that Rav Yosef used to turn down honors. And it's like today, like if you're an honorable person, if you're a person of stature, maybe the doctor will make house calls. But if you're just a run-of-the-mill person, so you go to the doctor's office. But if you're a very, very significant person, so the doctor comes to you. I imagine the president of the United States does not have to wait in line in the doctor's office. Okay, so Rav Yosef is not only turning down the Rosh Yeshiva job, he's also turning down honors that might get associated with a person of stature. Once you say that, I think the nitziv is tremendous, because who do we have in our Gemara in Sota? It's Rav Yosef who says, what do you mean there's no one who's none of? There's me. Let's posit for a second that this is after the 22-year period. Could not Rav Yosef fairly say, I'm an anav according to the nitziv? I mean, I did at least turn down honors. I mean, I turned down the Rosh Yeshiva position, I turned down the house calls from the bloodletter. At that point, it would make sense. Perhaps there's something else going on here, which I've been curious about for a while. There's a certain educational danger in the Gemara in Sota. So what does the Gemara in Sota say? When X passed away, this trait left. When Y passed away, the other trait left. That's all very legitimate. There is one problem, though. You could be conveying the idea that, you know, greatness used to exist in the world, and now we kind of, like, aspire to benign mediocrity. That's what we're into. Maybe Rav Yosef wanted to say, no, people are still capable of doing real things. You're saying nobody, imagine someone saying nobody turns down honor anymore. Rav Yosef says, look, I mean, I might not be the greatest person ever, but nobody turns down honor anymore. It's not true, I did it, right? There is still that capability in the world. Be that as it may, but notice what happened again. Rav Yosef told the joke. The Nitziv argues lurking in that joke was a real educational point. Anav doesn't mean you think you're terrible. That's not what the religious goal of humility is. Okay, let us do one last example of this, and we'll go to a totally different point about humor. The last example, before we get to source 11 in a second, that Gemara in Avodah Zarah. What happened to Avodah Zarah? We had a joke that Levi says, I guess I could leave now. But again, that's a joke that's told in the context of a story that really matters. It's important that when someone's choosing what to learn, so there's a couple of criteria, I would say. One criteria in terms of choosing what to learn is, well, what do you need to know? What does a knowledgeable Jew need to know? But there's another criteria, which is, what do you like to learn? This is an important criteria, right? There's no like set curriculum. Every Jew has to have this amount of Gemara learning, this amount of Chumash learning. It's quite healthy and good. People are attracted to different aspects of Torah. People like practical halacha, people like Tanakh, people like Jewish thought, people like Gemara. That is perfectly reasonable, and that's exactly what that Gemara is standing for. That's the point of Levi's joke. So in terms of our first theme we've had here, we talked about a humor that has wisdom to it. And I think we've seen that some of the Gemara's examples are not just an attempt to be funny, but an attempt to make a point. Let us go to source 11. We'll go to our second theme regarding humor. And here, I hope I don't run out of time, because we've got a tremendous pshat of Rav Kook. Okay, as many of you know, the Sefer Kohelet contradicts itself about a lot of issues. One of the issues in which it contradicts itself is that how to relate to joy, right? Some psukim seem to indicate joy is great, some indicate joy is problematic. So there's a Gemara in Shabbat which says, well, it depends what kind of joy. If it's a simcha shel mitzvah, right, you're joyous because of some very good thing you're doing, that's wonderful. If it's a simcha she'eno shel mitzvah, perhaps a more frivolous joy, then joy is not so great. That's the Gemara's answer. Then the Gemara says, joy helps a lot of religious endeavors. Joy helps prophecy. Famous pasuk that when the prophet is feeling down, he can't achieve the prophetic experience. He needs the minstrel to come and play some music to get him in a good mood. It says the same thing is true about learning. You want to succeed in learning? If you show up in the Beit Midrash with a big frown, it's not going to work. If you're happy, learning works. Then the Gemara challenges this. Let us go to four lines from the bottom. The line begins with Hamanagein, or five lines from the bottom. The middle of that line, it says Ini with a question mark. So the Gemara says, is that really true that learning is good? Learning works when you're happy. Ini, is it really so? V'amar Rav Gidol Amarav, didn't Rav Gidol say name Rav? Kol Tamen Chacham Shiyoshev Nei Rabo. Any scholar or student sitting before his Rebbe, Ve'ein sifto tov notfot mar. His lips are not dripping bitterness. Techavena, he should be singed. Meaning the ideal posture of the student here is bitterness. Now this seems a little bit bizarre. The Gemara would say, really, the student should be feeling pretty lousy. If they're bitter, that's the ideal posture for Gemara. To make it even more remarkable, look what the Gemara does with this pasuk. Shinema, what does the pasuk say in Shir Hashirim? Siftotav shoshanim, his lips are like lilies, notfot mor over, they're dripping myrrh. Very beautiful pasuk, right? Idyllic. Right, lilies, myrrh. Look what the Gemara does. No. Al tikri mor over, don't read it as myrrh, elamar over. It's bitterness. Not only that, al tikri shoshanim, don't read it as lilies, elashesh shonim. That learn. Now this is remarkable. Let's do the simple pshat in the pasuk. Siftotav shoshanim, his lips are like lilies, notfot mor, dripping myrrh. Now according to what we just did to the pasuk. Siftotav sheshonim, lips that are learning, notfot mar, they should be dripping bitterness. Okay, we'll come back to that in 1 second. So the Gemara is a contradiction. So the Gemara says there's two answers. Lo kasha, no difficulty. Haba rabba, haba talmud. It's the Rebbe versus the students. What do you say? Who's happy? Who's sad? Who's bitter? So I used to always make the following joke about this. That, well, if it's somebody, a Rebbe, who's been in yeshiva high school education too long and is burnt out, so the Rebbe's bitter and the students are happy. But that's not the pshat in the Gemara. Right? The pshat in the Gemara is that the Rebbe's happy and the students are bitter. Presumably because they're a little nervous, right? They can be called on, they might say something foolish, they're under pressure. So that's the simple pshat. The Rebbe is happy, he's the one who has the simcha, and the students have the bitterness. We'll come back to this in 1 minute. The e by Rema, a second answer, haba haba rabba. No, they're both the Rebbe. The lo kasha will resolve the contradiction in a different fashion. Ha mekamei de lefatach, one is before he begins this year. Ha levata de patach, one is after the shira started. And now there's a famous Gemara that brings us back to humor. Ki ha de rabba mekamei de patach lulu rabbanan, before he began teaching the rabbis. Amar milta de bichuta, here it is, very famous. Rabba began every shir with a joke. Ubadchi rabbanan, and the rabbis would laugh. Why did the Gemara have to put those two words in? Ubadchi rabbanan? It's obvious, because otherwise you wouldn't know if Rabba's jokes were funny or not. Right? So he told Milta de Bichuta, Ubadchi rabbanan, and the rabbis would laugh. Lesov, but at the end, Yatev beimata, he sat in trepidation, Upatach b'shmaitan, he began to learn it. Now let's review the Gemara's two answers. Answer one, the Rebbe is all joyous. The Rebbe has simcha, the students have the mar, have the merirut, they have the bitterness. Answer two, the Rebbe himself undergoes a transformation. Rebbe starts shir in a great mood. Rabba tells a joke at the beginning of shir. And then things get much more serious and perhaps frightening as the shir progresses. Okay. Let us now look at a beautiful, beautiful interpretation of this Gemara by Rav Kook. Okay, I'm very enamored, very enthusiastic with the agadic parts of Gemara. And we're always looking for good mefarshim on Agadah and the non-legal portions. Rav Kook has a tremendous parish on the Agadot of Brachot and Shabbat. Only the first two Masechtot, but it's a wonderful parish called Ein Hayah. So Rav Kook has a very, very profound reading of that Gemara. Rav Kook says as follows. Let's look at source 12. We're not going to read through the whole paragraph here, but I think you'll enjoy this reading very much. Kain kol Talmid Chacham Yishev Fnei Rabo. Let's say you have a scholar, but he's sitting before his Rebbe, right? So even though he calls him a Talmid Chacham, he needs to learn. Who odene b'matzav ha-matchilim. On some level, he's still almost like a beginner. Shu adayin zakuk l'rav l'hamido al hamet. He still needs the Rebbe to give him the pshat. V'ayosha b'darki ha-torah. The ein sifto tov not fon mar. What's the problem if his lips do not drip bitterness? Here we go. Hu chafetz kvar, this fellow once, shelo yelo divrei Torah la'amel. Torah should not involve toil. Ki im levakesh be metane'im la'ashashua. He only wants it to be pleasant and playful. And here I think Rav Kook is saying something very powerful. The bitterness of Rav Kook is not that you're in a bad mood. There's no ideal in Torah learning that you should be in a bad mood. No ideal like that whatsoever. The bitterness is a different point. And I'm going to clarify this with a story. And I think this is a crucial message for us here in modernity. I once had a very good student who used to come over to me during night seder and say, Rebbe, tell me a good vart. And if I told him a nice idea, he was quite bright, he could appreciate it. That was no problem. But if I said, oh, here, look up this Gemara and work through the Marsha and the Maral, you'll come to it yourself, that he was not interested in. I would say he was a consumer of Torah, not a producer. He just wanted to like get it off the rack, the finished product. Right, Torah should be nicely packaged for him, and then he'll learn to appreciate it. But to actually sweat, to struggle, to understand, this was something he was not interested in. I would say, by the way, that this is something we're particularly prone to modernity. Like, modernity is always trying to make life easier for us. Right, in fact, there's a tremendous mashal that I have to admit, I got it from a Danish philosopher. There's a mashal that Kierkegaard once tells, that he's sitting on a park bench. He says, you know, all of modern life, everybody's trying to make life easier. It occurred to me that maybe somebody should be trying to make life harder. Now, he doesn't mean that, of course, in a sadistic way, but that real growth in life often comes when not everything is so easily presented. If you think about it, you go into any Barnes & Noble, think about how much is dedicated to making life easy. Right, no, the Idiot's Guide to Whatever. Like, I imagine one day when you go to university, you'll be just given one volume that says The Idiot's Guide to Your Entire College Education. That'll just be it. You just have to read that book and you're good to go. Right, the next thing you know is Harvard Medical School. Right, so this is something I'm making fun of in terms of Barnes & Noble. I think we should be honest and say that maybe there's an element of this in the Torah learning world as well. That with all the goodness, there's no question that English translations have helped and halakhic compendiums, things that summarize for us, have helped. But I would just say as follows, I'm not against all that literature, but if your Torah learning never has any element of sweat, there's never any element of I'm struggling to understand, then maybe something's lacking. Maybe the most profound understanding does come from a little bit of effort. Not that everything is always so neatly packaged. It's like there is something to be thought of here. So Rav Kook says, that's the bitterness. The bitterness is not, is that you're in a bad mood. The bitterness is that there's hard work. Now, we're going to do the rest outside, but I think it's tremendous. Let's go through the Gemara's two answers here. What was answer number one? The Rebbe's happy and the students are bitter. According to Rav Kook, why does that work? It works great. Why is the Rebbe happy? The Rebbe's put in his time. He learned in yeshiva for many years. Now he had the bitterness long ago, but now he understands. He's just all happy. It's great. What could be better than teaching a good sugya? The students, on the other hand, they're bitter. Why are they bitter? Because they don't know it yet, right? They're struggling. They don't understand the Tosfos. So they have to deal. Again, it's not sadness, according to Rav Kook. It's the struggle. It's the, sometimes you get down, right? Any yeshiva student will tell you this. Like, you had a bad day. You couldn't make heads or tails of what you're trying to learn. So you're bitter. Okay. Now I think comes the most profound part. What happens when you go to the second answer? Why does the Rebbe shift gears in mid-year? So if you think about it for a second, it's obvious what Rav Kook is going to say. You're a Rebbe. You've taught this year before. You have a nicely worked out chakira that you say. It's just great. But if you're really authentically a good Rebbe, and you're really interested in learning, so the finished package doesn't always stay finished. Like a student asks a good question you had never anticipated. You think of a point you had not thought of before. I mean, the ongoing search for understanding Torah is endless. It doesn't end. And the Rebbe starts here with a joke. I mean, it's all easy, right? Everything is packaged. I've worked it out already. But a good educator sometimes will have the bitterness come in. Again, it's not a bitterness of sadness. It's a bitterness of effort. And if you think about the various rabbeim or even professors in college you have, I think you could think about this split. There are those who like, there's such a, everything is neatly packaged, nothing could possibly make a dent in it. You probably have college professors like this. You could have asked the greatest question in the history of human thought, but it will not make a dent in the lecture. The lecture just proceeds, as it were. And there are those who are authentically, you know, say, you asked a good question, you have to figure out how to deal with that, right? That's something to be thought about. So a good Rebbe, according to Rav Kook, moves from the simcha to the seriousness. And I think this brings us to our second point about humor. Which is, humor is a great thing. Humor cannot detract from the seriousness of purpose. And I think this is an important point. If you think about people we know who tell jokes, again, you could have someone who tells jokes, and they tell jokes, but they're still a very serious person. You could have someone who tells jokes, and it's a sense like nothing in life really matters. It's a certain lightheartedness, a lightheadedness to all of human endeavors. That's the kind of humor that we should be more wary of. So I think Rav Kook has given us a very nice model. What happens here, according to Rav Kook? Rabbah starts here with a joke. He's in a good mood. Being in a good mood is a good thing. Cheering, making the rabbis laugh is a good thing. L'sof yata be'mata means he gets serious. He says, no, learning Torah is a serious business. I'm going to struggle. It might even involve an element of bitterness in the struggle to understand. But that does not contradict my humor. So we now, I think, have two very good themes about humor. Theme one was a humor of quality, as opposed to a humor of coarseness or frivolity. Theme two is a humor that does not contradict the seriousness of life. One last thing about Rav Kook, and we'll go to the last source here. Rav Kook does something fascinating. When the Gemara says, Al Tikri X LOI, usually I'm not aware of somebody who finds meaning in both sides of the equation, both in the Al Tikri X and in the Y. Rav Kook does it here beautifully. What did our Gemara say? Al Tikri Shoshanim. Says Rav Kook, religious life is not a pleasant stroll through the rose garden. It's not like, you know, you walk around, you sniff the flowers, it's really great, but you never really have to do anything. No, sometimes you have to dig the dirt and cultivate the garden as well. So it's a tremendous shot. Al Tikri Shoshanim. Don't read it as just this stroll smelling the lilies. El Shesh Shonim, no Tvot Mar. There's a hard work component to Judaism also. Of course, it's quite rewarding, but it goes together. The reward and the work are cut from the same cloth. Okay, let us go to one last story. I think I've got 12 minutes to go. We should be okay. Let's go to story in Source 13. Is that right? Rob, I have till 10:30? Okay, excellent. Let's see what we have here. I think you'll enjoy this story very much. Rab Broka chuza v'shchiach b'shuku de Beileft. Rab Broka, the visionary, was in the market of Beileft. Ha'v'shchiach Eliyahu gabei. And Rab Broka, again, he's a visionary. He often converses with Eliyahu in this market. So if you converse with Eliyahu, you could ask him some very interesting questions. Amalei, ika b'hai shuku bar alma da'ati. Anybody in this market who has a share in the world to come? Pretty remarkable. Look around. How about the butcher, the grocer? Who's going to make it to Olam Haba in this market? Amar Leilo, Eliyahu says, sorry, a little bit of a tough day in the market. No one here is going to make it to Olam Haba. Adahachi v'hachi, in the meanwhile, Chazal hugava davasai masani uchme. He saw somebody who was putting on black shoes. I'm not really aware of the socio-historical reality of shoe wearing, but apparently Jews wore different color shoes than their Gentile neighbors. And this fellow was wearing the non-Jewish shoe color. Okay, so he's putting on the black shoes. And here, even though it says tchelet, it means tzitzis. Nor is he wearing tzitzis on his garment. So here's this guy, he's dressing like a non-Jew. He doesn't put on tzitzit. As you might imagine, of course, Eliyahu points to him. Amarlei, hi this guy, bar al-madatiyu. He's the one who's going to make it to Olam Haba. Now this, of course, intrigues greatly Rab Broka Chuza. Rahat patre, he runs after him. Amarlei, ma'yuv d'chal, what's your job? Amarlei, zilei ed nevetal machar. I can't tell you. Come back to the market tomorrow and I'll tell you. L'machar amalei mayav decha. So Rabbi Chaza, you imagine his curiosity is really, he's thinking about it all night. What does this fellow do? What's your job? Amalei zandukna ana. I'm a jail warden. Vasarna gavri l'chud v'nashi l'chud. And I keep the men and women separate. Now, we all know prisons are not known as the moral exemplars of humanity. Unfortunately, prisons are a place where very bad things take place, rape and other things. So this jail warden is somewhat heroic. I make sure that the men and women are kept separate. Not only that, Ramina Purai, I placed my bed ben Hani Lahani. Meaning, I'm in the middle there. You can imagine this is a very powerful movie scene. Right? All the hardened criminals, all the men are on one side, the women are the other. And this jail warden is plopping himself right in the middle there. They're all giving him dirty looks, but he is making sure that nothing problematic takes place in the prison. So this is a very powerful scene. Then skipping down a bit, it turns out this guy has another role to play. If we skip down a bit to the line that begins with Durdaya, the middle of that line, Amarle, my tama let lecha chute, how come you don't put on tzitzis for amit misani uchmi? How come you don't dress like a Jew? Amarle, ayalna v'nafikna beni nachrim. I go in amongst the non-Jews, kihecha delo leidu diudana. They should not know I'm Jewish. I.e., it's going to soon become clear that this fellow is a spy. Right, he's a spy, he hangs around the non-Jewish circles. If there's any edicts coming that might be problematic or dangerous to the Jews, he gets quick awareness of them, he immediately informs the Jewish authorities. That's what this fellow does. So now it becomes clear why this fellow is going to make it to Olam Haba. He is both the heroic jail warden and the heroic spy. Okay, now the Gemara continues. We'll get to the humor in a second. Let us go now to three lines from the bottom. The line that begins with Gzeirata, and I'm towards the end of that line. Adahaki v'hachi atu hanach treyati. Two other fellows come. Eliyahu apparently is still there. Amalei hanach nami bnei alma da'ati ninu. Eliyahu says these two guys are also going to make it to the world to come. Azal agabayu. He went to them. Now here I have to point out one thing. It's not crucial humor, but it fits into my last theme about how the ongoing search for understanding continues endlessly. You know, I've taught this more about 20 times in my life. I thought of a question for the 18th time that I never thought of before. That how come with the first case, what was the verb? Rahat batre. Rab Broka Chuza runs after it. When it comes to these two guys, it says azal agabayu, which sounds more like a little stroll. So if anyone has any ideas, I'm curious. I have three suggestions that have come up since I've mentioned this twice now. So one suggestion is that the first guy was, his lack of Jewish dress was more intriguing. That's one suggestion. Another suggestion might be, someone said to me in Baltimore over Shabbos, someone said to me, well, maybe the spy was running away, so he had to run to catch him. Maybe it was practical. Maybe just the second one is not as interesting as the first one. Be that as it may, I'm just pointing out again, it's a good example how you think you have a finished package and something new comes up that you had not thought of before, and although I have to admit, it didn't make me bitter at all, it made me happy. And then you're still trying to think about what the meaning is. Okay, let's keep going. Who are these two guys? Armelu mai uvdaichu, what's your job? Amulei inchi beduche anan. We are comedians, remarkable. Why are comedians going to make it to Olam Haba? Mavdechina natzivi. First of all, we cheer up the depressed. Now that's pretty obvious, but I think there's a more interesting second example. Inami, ki chazinen beitrei ditlu tigra badai. If we see two people that have a strife, tarchina and vavdina lushlam, we make peace. Now this is interesting. Because you might have said, well, what does that have to do with humor? That has to do with being a peacemaker. Like, you're good with people, you could calm them down. But apparently, and the Gemara is absolutely right about this, humor can play a very important role in resolving strife. And I think if we think about it, maybe some of us use this. Like, you see that two of your children are starting to irritate each other a little bit. But you know, right at this moment, if you say something funny, you'll be able to kind of distract them from the thing that's irritating. I think with adults also we could use this. Now, I admit that at a certain point it'll be too late. I freely admit. At the point where they're yelling and screaming at each other and picking up the baseball bat, right, this is not going to work. Right, a good joke at that point does not calm them down. But I think when they're at the cusp of losing it, humor is a very, very powerful tool. Very powerful tool in restoring peace. Now, this Gemara is a remarkable Gemara, because what do we have here? We have humor as an incredible social tool. And I think those of us who, with a good sense of humor, or even those of us who don't, but occasionally can tell a good joke, this is a very powerful thing. Right? We have humor cheering up people who are depressed, the ability of humor to make peace. This, I think, is another theme of humor we should think about. Now, I want to say one other point about this Gemara, but I just want to summarize the three themes so far. We've shown that the Gemara has jokes. I think that's clear. Different kinds of jokes, in fact. We saw the Rav Lifshitz's idea that we should make a qualitative joke, a joke of intelligence, a joke of refinement, not a joke of coarseness. I think that's an important distinction. Secondly, we saw Rav Cook's idea that humor should not detract from the seriousness of purpose. That's Rabba. Rabba could start every shiur with a joke, but still be very serious about what he's doing. Thirdly, we have this idea of the tremendous social potential of humor. The beauty of humor to make people feel better, to resolve conflicts. This is not a minor thing. Let me make two last points here. We'll close this year. I often find it fascinating, the juxtaposition of this Gemara in Tanit. Who's going to make it to the world to come in this market? The jail warden / spy and the two comedians. Let me ask you the following question. Let's say you're going to make a Hollywood movie about this Gemara. Who are the lead actors going to want to play? All right, so if you think about it, what's going to be more popular? Probably like a dramatic action movie. Right? Dramatic action, you'll get the first guy, of course, you want to play the jail warden. Right? He stares down the hardened criminals. He sneaks into the court to find out what's happening regarding non-Jewish edicts. This is a very dramatic scene. The other one, what do? Sachakol, like, they walk around, tell a few jokes, cheer somebody up. Like, where is the drama in the second scene? I'd like to argue that the Gemara is doing this on purpose. That Gemara wants us to think about two different models of heroic behavior. That there is the dramatic model of heroic behavior, like you save the Jews from calamity, but there is a much more subtle model of heroic behavior. Like, you're not saving anyone from calamity, or maybe you are actually, but like you're in shul and you see two people are starting to not get along and you come over and make a joke and help resolve the conflict. I think this is an important point because, quite frankly, most of us are not going to be presented with a first opportunity for humor. First opportunity for heroism, excuse me. Like, no one has come to me in recent years saying, Rabbi, we've got a great spy mission for you, and here it is. But the latter is something we're all presented with all the time. So perhaps the Gemara needed to have the second group of people who make it to Olam Haba, because that's a crucial model for all of us. Okay, let me close with one last point. Let us look at Source 14. This is a comfort for any of you who do public speaking. You'll all be comforted by this. Rabbi Akiva haya yoshe v'doresh. Rabbi Akiva is giving a drasha. What more can you want? Rabbi Akiva is giving the drasha. V'nisnamu atalmidim. And they're all dozing. Rabbi Akiva looks around and he's the only one alert. There it is. Baal Ara. He wants to wake him up. He wants to wake up the shir. Amar, he says, Ma zachta Esther l'mlocha shev v'esrim u'me'a medina. Why did Esther merit to be the queen of 127 provinces? Elakach Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is what God said. Tavo Esther bitar shel Sarah. Let Esther, the descendant of Sarah, come. Shechaita sheva esu mea shana, Sarah imenu lived for 127 years. V'timloch al sheva esu medina. Let her then be the queen of 127 provinces. Now, notice what happened. Why did Rabbi Akiva say this? Apparently not necessarily because it was true. He said this to wake him up. Like, maybe I'll say something a little bit surprising or shocking. We'll see all of a sudden somebody in the fourth row is like, head is about to hit the table. So what? What was that about Sarah and Esther and 127 provinces? Now, this is not quite a joke. But I think there is something to this also. The power of humor in an educational context. No question, this is something very powerful. Right? Students will often prefer a teacher who's able to say something funny. Now again, obviously given a choice between someone who tells great jokes and has lousy content, and someone with good content with a lousy sense of humor, I think it is a no-brainer. One will have to go with the good content. But all things being equal, this is another very, very powerful aspect of humor. So I think we've seen a good reason why religious life should include humor. We talked about the educational value of humor. We've talked about, which, by the way, again, we're all teachers on some level because we all teach our children. And there also, humor has a powerful role to play. We talked about the social value of humor in the comedians. But we talked about two caveats. The two crucial caveats about a Jewish approach to humor is that life is still serious business, as Rava says. He'll tell a joke, but then Shir gets serious. And secondly, that humor is not about, you know, I am stupid or a buck of water falling on somebody's head. It's not about profanity. There's a humor of refinement and a humor of coarseness. And we should strive, of course, for the humor of refinement and intelligence. And if we do that, there's no question, I believe, that humor has a very powerful role to play in religious life. Okay, thank you very much.